From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On Tuesday, Charlie Hayden, one of the greatest living bass players, turned 65. He'll celebrate with a series of duet performances in New York. On today's Fresh Air, we hear excerpts from three interviews with Hayden. We'll talk about singing country music on his parents' radio show, joining the original Ornette Coleman Quartet, which changed the direction of jazz, and forming his group Quartet West. And he'll tell us about how having polio as a child affected his music and his life. Also, film critic Henry Sheehan reviews the new Steven Soderbergh film Full Frontal. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. A federal judge in Washington has ruled that the Bush administration must release the names of prisoners it's holding as part of its investigation into the September 11th attacks. Judge Gladys Kessler gave the Justice Department 15 days to start releasing names. She said the only names which may be kept secret are those of prisoners who are material witnesses to a terror investigation or those of prisoners who don't want to be identified. The Bush administration has said that releasing the names could allow terrorist groups to figure out what government investigators know. The case was brought by more than 20 civil liberties groups who said that holding prisoners in secret is an abuse of power. The Bush administration failed today to derail a lawsuit that challenges the legality of Vice President Dick Cheney's Energy Policy Task Force. At a hearing this morning, the judge overseeing the case gave the administration's lawyers a tongue-lashing. NPR's Peter Overby reports.
Judge Emmett Sullivan flatly rejected the administration's main assertion that the lawsuit, or even the fact-finding preliminaries, would intrude into the effective functioning of the presidency and vice presidency. Deputy Assistant Attorney General Shannon Coffin said there's a strong presumption that the government complies with the law. Sullivan shot back, but the government doesn't always comply with the law. The plaintiffs, the watchdog group Judicial Watch and the Sierra Club, contend that the task force included corporate lobbyists as it wrote its energy policy. Larry Klayman of Judicial Watch.
This administration believes it's above the law, and it doesn't have to answer any questions, and that's why we've been fighting for a year to get all this information out.
The administration has 30 days to contest Sullivan's decision. Peter Overby, NPR News, Washington.
The United Nations is reacting with skepticism to Iraq's offer for new weapons talks. Baghdad is offering to bring the UN's top weapons inspector back to Iraq. Linda Fasulo is at the United Nations.
UN Secretary General Kofi Annan said he welcomed Iraq's letter, but made it clear that Baghdad's proposal was, quote, at variance with a 1999 UN Security Council resolution governing Iraq's disarmament. But Annan said he would discuss the plan with Security Council members this Monday. In the letter, Iraq's Foreign Minister Najib Sabri said Baghdad wanted Chief Weapons Inspector Hans Blix to conduct a comprehensive review of Iraq's weapons compliance. But UN officials say that would contradict Security Council requirements, which call for UN inspectors to first return to Iraq to determine what has transpired since they left in 1998. For NPR News, I'm Linda Fasulo at the United Nations.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials lost 193 points, or nearly 2.3%, to close at 8,313. The NASDAQ lost 32 points, or 2.5%. This is NPR News. The French figure skating judge at the center of a vote-rigging scandal denies knowing the Russian accused of organizing the scheme. She was suspended from judging after a scandal at the Salt Lake City Olympic Games. NPR's Nick Spicer reports from Paris.
Marie-Hélène Le Goung says she doesn't know the man, hasn't heard of him, and hasn't had any contact with him. But FBI agents say they have recorded Alazam Toutakounov saying on the phone he had put Olympic judges in his pocket. At the time of the recording, the Olympic Games were about to be hit by controversy. A Russian couple was awarded the gold medal, even though the male skater nearly fell. Le Goung was one of the judges and caused an outcry by giving them a good score. She and the head of the French Skating Federation were suspended later after allegations of vote swapping to favor French skaters in another competition. Le Goung, however, says she still thinks the Russians were the best. U.S. federal prosecutors this week charged Toutakounov over suspected vote rigging. He was arrested in Italy, but it may be months before his extradition. Nick Spicer, NPR News, Paris.
Boston Cardinal Bernard Law testified today in a court case brought by people who claimed that they were sexually abused by a priest. Law denied that the Archdiocese of Boston had reached a final agreement to pay a $30 million settlement to 86 people who say they were molested by defrocked priest John Gagan. An attorney for the alleged victim showed the cardinal a newspaper article in which Law welcomed the settlement. Cardinal Law said that at the time he believed the settlement was only proposed and not final. The archdiocese later backed out of the settlement, saying it was too costly and that all the parties had not signed it. In stocks today, the S&P 500 gained 11 points. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Geraldine R. Dodge Foundation, sponsoring the 9th Biennial Dodge Poetry Festival in New Jersey, September 19th through the 22nd, on the web at grdodge.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Charlie Hayden is among the most important bass players in jazz history. He turns 65 next Tuesday and will celebrate with 2 weeks of duet performances at the Blue Note in New York. We're going to listen back to highlights of several interviews Hayden recorded on Fresh Air. First, let's hear something from his latest CD, Nocturne, featuring Cuban-born pianist Gonzalo Rubalcaba. Charlie Hayden from his latest CD, Nocturne. Hayden helped change the shape of jazz in the late 50s and early 60s as a member of the original Ornette Coleman Quartet. In 1969, he launched his own group, the Liberation Music Orchestra, whose music was inspired by democracy movements around the world. In 1986, he founded his group Quartet West, whose sound evokes film noir, detective novels, and Los Angeles of the 40s and 50s, and pays tribute to jazz singers of the 40s and 50s. Hayden grew up in a family of singers that performed on their own country music radio show. We'll talk about that a little later. First, let's hear Hayden with the Ornette Coleman Quartet playing Lonely Woman, recorded in 1959. The Ornette Coleman Quartet featuring Charlie Hayden on bass. In 1985, Hayden told me about his first encounter with Coleman.
I was 19 years old, and we played all day long, and he had a room full of music strewn all over the floor, the walls, the ceiling. He was constantly writing music, and he told me before we started to play, he said, "Charlie, I've written these pieces now, and here's the chord changes. Now, these are the chord changes that I heard inside myself when I was writing the melody, but these are just a guide for you. I want you to be inspired from them and create your own chord structure from the inspiration or from the feeling of what I've written. And that way, constantly, a new chord structure will be evolving, and we will be constantly modulating, and we'll be listening to each other, and we will make some exciting music. And that's exactly what happened.
Were you surprised at how controversial the music was when you started playing it? You know, a lot of people couldn't handle it at all, musicians, listeners.
I was very involved in learning about the playing. We were all involved because it was a brand new language. We didn't even think of it as being a brand new language. We only thought of it as we're hearing something and we got to play it. And we were constantly learning about what it was we were doing. Things were being born every day out of what we were doing. And there was a lot of controversy around us. When we opened up at the Five Spot in New York, fights used to break out right in the club. People would be putting us down. People would be praising us. The club was packed every night with everybody from different parts of the art world, painters, famous writers, filmmakers, dancers, musicians. I would look out, and standing at the bar would be Paul Chambers, Percy Heath, Charlie Mingus, and they would be looking dead in my eye, you know, and saying, okay, what are you going to do? And I would be playing and have my eyes closed, and one night I opened my eyes, and there was Leonard Bernstein with his ear glued to the front of my instrument. And I looked over to Arnett and said, what is this? He says, I'll tell you later. And then we were invited to Leonard Bernstein's table. He invited us to the Philharmonic rehearsals, and he couldn't believe that I was self-taught, and he wanted to try and get me to study music. And he was very helpful in me getting a Guggenheim Fellowship 10 years later in composition. But it was like that every night. It was very exciting. The violence wasn't exciting. I mean, one guy set somebody's car on fire one night, I remember. Somebody came back in the kitchen. We were standing talking with Ornette, and I won't say who it was, and hit Ornette in the face. You know, I mean, it was really a very strong excitation time. New things were happening, not only in music, but in people's minds every night from that music, you know. And people were always asking me why I was the only white musician, and I never thought about that until people asked me about it, you know. But that's the way life is. That's the way human beings are.
Charlie Hayden recorded in 1985. We talked more about Ornette Coleman in our 1996 interview. Now, when you were young, in your early 20s, I guess, you started playing with Ornette Coleman's group. When you first met Ornette Coleman, which was before he was known to anyone, what was he doing that coincided with what you wanted to do?
I'd been going to a lot of jam sessions and playing in L.A. with a lot of different people, and sometimes I would hear... I mean, I love playing on chord changes. That's the reason that I love this music, and I love improvising on beautiful changes that inspire you. But sometimes I wanted to stay on a certain part of the song and keep playing, and sometimes I wanted to play on the inspiration of a piece rather than on the chord structure. But, I mean, I couldn't put it into words back then, but whenever I tried to do what I was hearing, people would get upset. And when I heard Ornette play, that's what he was doing. I mean, that's the way he played all the time.
How do you think your playing was permanently changed by playing with Ornette Coleman?
Well, it wasn't changed. It was really deeply affected. I mean, it was a way that I learned about listening to the musicians that you were playing with at the moment you're playing with them. It's so important to listen to everyone. And that's the way it was really affected by playing with Ornette. Plus the fact that I developed this really strong desire, you know, to play with my whole life on the line, to be willing to give my life for every note I play, that every note is really, really important. Each note for people to hear, you know. The reason that we're playing this music is to bring more people to this art form so that they can see that it's a beautiful art form and it can touch their life in a really great way and enhance their life. And that there's an alternative, you know, this music is an alternative for people to know about and to experience. So I think that's why we were all playing. That's why I play now, is to bring people near this art form.
Charlie Hayden recorded in 1996. We'll hear more from Hayden after a break. This is Fresh Air. Bass player and composer Charlie Hayden is celebrating his 65th birthday on Tuesday. We're listening back to his Fresh Air interviews and his music. Before we get back to our 1996 interview, let's listen to Hayden's composition, Here's Looking at You, recorded with his group Quartet West in 1995.
I think that you're the most melodic bass player that I can think of.
And oh, thanks.
Yeah, especially when you're improvising. There's a sense of melodic sweep to the lines that you play. I think a lot of bass players just think more harmonically, and they think about rhythm, but not so much about melody.
Well, I was brought up with melodies all my life from the time I was, well, even before I was two, when I started singing on my parents' radio show every day. My mom told me once, she said, you know, when I used to rock you to sleep, I used to hum all these songs. She knew all these great folk songs like Barbara Allen and Mansion on the Hill and Silver Threads Among the Gold and Wildwood Flower. And she used to hum all these songs while she was rocking me to sleep when I was a baby. And, you know, one of my brothers and sisters would be walking through the living room and while she would be humming in the rocking chair, and they would start humming the harmony with her because everybody sang all the harmony parts on our show. They all knew how to do that by ear. And then my mom would sometimes switch to the harmony and they would switch to the melody, and I was hearing all this stuff. And she said one day she was humming to me and I started humming the harmony with her, you know, and before she said, well, I guess that's a signal for you to go on the show, you know. So I started on the radio show when I was 22 months old. It's real important, melodies and harmonies. You know, I tell my students at CalArts that they should be able to harmonize every melody that they know by ear, every harmony part. And it's so important. I was really lucky to be brought up around melodies of the Carter family and the Delmore brothers and Hank Williams and all those people that my parents knew. And I guess it was a very strong musical training in my young life. I acquired a melodic sense very early on. I'm very, very fortunate that I was raised around that great music.
Charlie, how do you see the role of the bass in a band? You know, I think a lot of people think that since the bass isn't usually the lead instrument, that it's kind of in the background someplace. As the leader of a group who's a bass player and composer, how do you see your bass fitting in?
I think the role of a bass player, as far as in the rhythm section, is to really lift everything up and make it deeper and make it more full sounding. When I was a kid listening to classical music on the radio or whatever, I was even in country music, when the bass player stopped playing, it's kind of like the depths kind of left the music for me. That's why I always wanted to play bass, and it's really important if bass players enhance everything behind the solo so that you can inspire the other musicians to play better than they've ever played before. That's what I always try to do.
What part did you sing with your family when you were a boy? And your family had a country music radio show and performed country music all around.
I sang all the harmony parts. I couldn't wait to get to the studio every day. I loved it. Every day, my parents would choose the songs that we were going to play out of their vast library of songs from the Carter family and the Delmore brothers and all the hymns that we had. And we would go over them, and then we would go on the air. Sometimes we had radio studios in our homes wherever we were living. We moved around a lot, but mostly we would go to the studio at the radio station and do our show every day. I loved going to the studio, and I liked the air conditioning and the acoustical tile, the acoustical tile and the big windows, that had triple, quadruple glass. And this was back in 1945, 46, 47, 48, 49. It was a great experience.
I can't believe you had radio studios in your home. Would you do remotes from your own home?
Yeah. Where I was born in Shenandoah, Iowa, we were on a radio station there called KMA. It's still there. And my dad moved our family to Springfield, Missouri, in the Ozark Mountains. And my grandparents, my father's mother and father, had a farm outside Springfield, and my dad always wanted to do farming. So he got this farm down the road, gravel road. I went to a one-room schoolhouse there, Bellevue School. And in our farmhouse, my dad had the radio station come out and hook up a remote thing where, the things that you ring where you turn the crank?
Mm-hmm.
Well, he used to turn this crank, and the ring would go into the studio in Springfield. And that was a signal for us to go on the air, and we start the theme song. And we did it from our show from the radio, from our home, from our farmhouse, for several years before we moved into the city, and went over to the station every day.
So did you play in churches and at revival meetings and stuff in addition to singing on the radio?
We played in churches. We played personal appearances all over. My parents were on the Grand Ole Opry quite a few times.
You know what I'm wondering? If singing at churches and other like religious events, revivals, whatever, if that gave you a sense that music had this spiritual potential in it?
Well, the hymns especially that we sing, And then my mom used to take me I don't know why she chose me to take, but I was the one child. She had six kids, I had three brothers and two sisters. And several Sunday mornings, quite a few Sunday mornings actually, when I was around 9 years old, she would take me to the African American church in Springfield. There was just one of them. And we would go in after everyone was there. We would kind of like quietly go in the entrance, and we would sit in the back row, and we would just listen to the choir. It was like one of the most beautiful things that I've ever experienced in my life, to hear that music, the spirituals and the gospel music, and I'll never forget that. Yes, I had a really early contact with spirituals and hymns, and I had a feeling right away that there was a spirituality in music. I mean, when you talk about jazz, I believe 85-90% of improvisation in jazz is spiritual. You know, it's a spirituality that's you can go to school and learn the academics of music and the fundamentals and scales and chords and composition and all that, but when you start to play and you tell a story to people and you take people on a journey that you want to take them on, it's all about spirituality.
Charlie, a recent album of yours is an album of spirituals, hymns, and folk songs, and it features you with the pianist Hank Jones. It's an album of duets. Are any of these songs that you used to do as a child?
Yeah, we used to do Abide With Me and some of the other hymns that we do, Amazing Grace, on the album.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, every hymn that's on Steal Away, we used to sing, and Hank and I chose which hymns and which spirituals. He had a lot of spirituals. Hank was from the spiritual part of it, and he knew all these great songs. And my favorite one that I've ever heard him play was It's Me, O Lord, Standing in the Need of Prayer, and that's the one that I heard on the Smithsonian Collection of Jazz Piano that inspired me to do the record with him. And I called him as soon as I heard it, and I said, man, that's one of the most beautiful things I've ever heard. Could we play spirituals together sometime? And he said, Charlie, I'd really love to do it. Let's do it.
Charlie Hayden recorded in 1996. We'll hear more of his interviews and music in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Here's one of the spirituals we were just talking about, performed with Hank Jones.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, bass player Charlie Hayden tells us why he stopped singing and how he started again. And film critic Henry Sheehan reviews Full Frontal, directed by Steven Soderbergh. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Charlie Hayden, one of the most important bass players in jazz history, turned 65 on Tuesday. He's celebrating with a series of duet performances at the Blue Note in New York. We're celebrating by listening back to highlights of his Fresh Air interviews. When we left off, we were talking about his childhood when he sang with his family on their country music radio show.
You stopped singing as a child for a while because, I guess you stopped singing altogether because of polio?
Yeah, I had bulbar polio, which there was an epidemic going on in 52. And we were in Omaha, Nebraska. We had a television show there. This was right before my dad retired from music. And I got this virus and it paralyzed. I was really lucky, actually, because most of the hospitals were filled with polio patients, and it was all paralyzed lung, function and legs, and mine hit my vocal cords. For some reason, the left side of my throat and my face, and the doctor said I was a very lucky guy, and I eventually got over it, but the thing that I couldn't do anymore, the range in my voice kind of left me. I couldn't sing. I loved singing, but I wasn't able to sing anymore.
So what's the connection between the polio and not being able to sing and learning to play bass?
Well, I really don't know if there's a connection. I was playing bass before I had polio. I mean, I was playing my brother's bass. He wouldn't let me play his bass, but every time I could sneak into where he kept the bass, I would go in and play it, And I love playing the bass with records that we had and then when I was 14 in Omaha, I was in the ninth grade. They had an orchestra at school at North High, and the orchestra director wanted me to play bass. When he found out I play bass, he said, "We need another bass in the bass section of the orchestra." And I said, "I can't read music." And he said, "Well, I can teach you." So he took me down to the band room. His name was Sam Thomas. I'll never forget it, man. And he showed me the first page of the Simandl book, the bass method book, and all the open strings were there. And he said, "Now I want you to practice playing these with a bow. This is a G, this is a D, this is an A and an E, and practice this while I'm gone. And then we'll start on the half position, and we'll go to the first position to where you press down the strings, He said, "You're playing this anyway by ear, with the little band you have here at school, but now you're going to know how to read it." And I said, "Great." So he left the room, and I started getting real nervous, I mean, I got this anxiety attack. I said, "Oh, my," I looked at these notes, and I was bowing, and all of a sudden, I thought I was having a heart attack. And, can you imagine having a heart attack at 14? And so, man, I grabbed my chest. I put the bass down. I went out and ran out in the hall to the water fountain and started drinking all this water. And a couple of students came up to me, my friends, and said, "What in the world's wrong?" I said, "I think I'm having a heart attack." I said, "Charlie, you're out of your mind. You're not having a heart attack." I said, "I think I am." And Sam Thomas came back, and he was cracking up, man. He said, "You're not having a heart attack, Charlie. You're just, learning how to read music."
So did you finally overcome your fear
of
that?
Yeah. No, I played with the school orchestra. It was really great. And
that probably opened up a whole new world of music, too. Music you'd only have access to if you could read.
That's right.
I want to ask you about something that I figure must be affecting your music in some way. I think you have a ringing in your ears problem, which I know a lot of musicians get from being either too close to loud amplifiers, to loud speakers, or too close to drums. How bad is the problem? Does it drown out the music? Does it affect what you hear?
Well, it's to a point where while I'm here talking to you, I've got the volume on these headphones almost off. I have also a condition called hyperacusis, which is extreme sensitivity to loud sound. In other words, if someone was to drop a fork on the floor or a plate or there's any kind of sudden sound, loud sound, it's like hitting me in the head. It really hurts me. And the doctors tell me that there's a membrane in the inner or middle ear that protects the ear from loud sound, and it's not working in my case. And so it's like the volume is turned up in my head. I hear stuff triple louder than most people do. Whenever I take a hearing test, I go over the limit on the hearing test. I hear so well. And a lot of people with this other condition I have called tinnitus, most people that have tinnitus, they lose their hearing. But in my case, my hearing's just becoming more and more acute, and I hear this ringing in my head that is so loud that if most people heard what I hear, they would run down the street screaming. But I've adjusted to it over the years, and I just made it a part of my life, you know, and I kind of put up with it. But it's... if I stop and think about it, I get real depressed. So let's change the... No, I'm just kidding.
Well, does it drown out the music that you play?
Oh, no. No, it doesn't. I wear earplugs when I play.
So that the other musician sounds aren't too severe for you?
Yeah, so it'll soften the decibels.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Well, Charlie, I'd like to go out with something from your new Quartet West album. And you end the album with something called Now Is the Hour. It's the title track of the record. And you say it's a Maori farewell song. How did you learn this song, and tell us something about it?
I used to listen to this song on the radio during World War II. Bing Crosby recorded it, and it sold millions of records. And Vera Lynn, I believe, in England recorded it. It was a very well-known song during World War II because it depicted, you know, the guy going off to war and his wife saying, you know, when you come back, I'll be waiting for you. And but we must say goodbye now. And I just love this song. And, you know, I have a lot of songs that I have from my childhood that I'm saving up to do with whatever band that I hear it with. And this was one of them. And then I was speaking to Alan Broadbent, who's from New Zealand, about the song. And he said, you know, that's a Maori folk farewell song. And I said, well, I guess that's where it came from. You know, so I knew then what we had to do it, because Alan also was close to the song, and so we did.
Would you sing the song as you remember it?
Well, I'll try. Now is the hour when we must say goodbye. Soon you'll be sailing far across the sea. While you're away, oh, then remember me. When you return, you'll find me waiting here.
That's a really lovely song.
Yeah.
Charlie Hayden recorded in 1996. Let's hear his version of the Maori love song as recorded on his 1996 CD, Now Is the Hour. We'll hear an excerpt of our 1999 interview with Charlie Hayden after a break. This is Fresh Air.
We're celebrating the 65th birthday of jazz bass player and composer Charlie Hayden by listening back to his Fresh Air interviews. When we left off with our 1996 interview, it ended with me coaxing him to sing. I was surprised and delighted 3 years later to find that he sang on the final track of his CD, The Art of the Song. You, as a rule, don't sing on your CDs. I think this is your first recorded performance outside of the years when you sang with your family. When you were a child, your family had a country group and used to sing on the radio. So tell us the story about how you decided to sing on your own CD.
I stopped singing on our show when I was 15. I developed bulbar polio and it paralyzed my vocal cords. And eventually, you know, I got my vocal cords back, but I lost the range in my voice. And I used to sing every day on our radio show from the time I was 2 until I was 15. And after that occurrence, I kind of focused all my musical melody energy into my playing. I just started playing the bass and playing along with records around where we were living in Springfield, Missouri. And then when I moved to L.A., playing, you know, seeking out the great musicians. And I never really thought about singing again after that. And I didn't even sing in the shower. You know, it wasn't that I was afraid to. It was just like it was over, you know, for me. And so recently some people have been talking about, you know, you used to sing, how come you don't sing anymore, or sing, you know, Ruth, my wife, who's a singer, has said, you know, why don't you sing? And then actually one day I was on your show a while ago, and we were talking about Now is the Hour, and you asked me to sing it, and I was very reluctant, and I couldn't believe that you asked me, and I finally gave in and sang, and you called back later and said that you thought it was great and that I should sing sometime on one of my records. And I said, well, thanks for the compliment, Terry. And, you know, I just kind of, it was kind of humorous to me, and I never really took it seriously until we started planning this record. And I was going through music, and I ran across some of our music from our radio show with my family back in the 40s, And I saw this song called The Wayfaring Stranger that my mom used to sing and on our show. And I remembered how beautiful it was. And then I was going through some LPs and CDs, and I found this recording of Joe Stafford singing folk music. And one of the songs on the album was The Wayfaring Stranger. And I listened to it, and it reminded me of how beautiful the song was. And so I thought about doing it on the record instrumentally. And then I thought, you know, this isn't a song for Shirley or Bill to sing, but it should really be sung because the words are so beautiful. Because I remembered when my mom sang it. And so I said, well, the only way it could be sung is if I sing it. And I thought, you know, oh my goodness, that's not going to work. And Alan was over, and I played it for him. I said, what do you think of this? And he said, wow, that is really beautiful. I said, what would you think if I tried to sing it? And he said, wow. He said, that'd be different. And I said, so.
What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I said, well, you know, and I even, I called Jean-Philippe Allard, our executive producer in Paris, and I said, you know, I might sing on this record. And there was a big silence. And he said, pardon? I said, I might sing. And then another long silence. Pardon? I said, anyway, I told Alan, I said, write the arrangement as if somebody's going to sing it. And if I don't make it, I'll play it on the bass, you know. And so he wrote the arrangement. I didn't practice the song, you know, a couple of times, you know, I was a little nervous. I around the house, I kind of sang the melody at home just to go through it, just to make sure that I could actually sing, you know. And I didn't want to do it too much because, you know, I didn't want to get my mindset in like, oh, I'm a singer and I've got to sing this like a singer and it's got to be perfect. because I really believe singers, and that's why I love Shirley Horn and Bill Henderson so much, is that they sing the way they speak. I mean, when they stop speaking and start to sing, they don't change their voice or any, the way they say their words or anything about what they're doing in any way. They just, it's just natural and honest, and that's why they're such great singers. And you know, a lot of singers now, and even in the past, as soon as they began to sing, they everything changes, it's all of a sudden somebody else, you know. And so I didn't want to make myself nervous, so we got into the studio, and I just got up to the microphone, and they started to play it, and I sang. And Shirley Horn came in to me, and she said, "You got to put this on the record." And I said, "Are you really serious?" She said, "Yes." And she said, "Some of those string players out there are in tears." I said, "Well, that's probably because it's so bad, you know." She said, "So I put it on the record, and I hope people like it. It's not doing it as a singer; it's doing it to tell a story of, you know, where I come from." And
well, I really love this, and I'm so glad that you went through with singing it and listening to it. I was wondering, you know, knowing that you knew this song as a kid and that your mother sang it. When you were a child, what did the words mean to you? The song is just filled with metaphors about death, you know, crossing over the River Jordan. I'm going home to see my mother. I'm going home to see my father. What did you get about that? And was it a frightening song to you, thinking about death, or what?
No, it actually is a very soothing song. It's just the opposite of me. It's a song about life.
Mm-hmm.
I remember a very funny thing that my mom told me once when I was 4 years old. She was working around we lived on a farm outside Springfield, Missouri, and she was working around the house, and all of a sudden she heard me screaming in the living room, and she thought, you know, I'd done something horrible had happened to me. She ran in the living room. She said, "Charlie, what's wrong?" And I looked up at her, and I said, "I'm going to die." And she said, "What in the world are you talking about?" And she said, "You're thinking about," she said, "you don't have," she was like cracking up, you know, so... I always have this deep need for the beauty of life, the reason for life, and the preciousness of life, you know, and how precious every moment is that we're alive, and we should really do everything that we can to enhance this life that we have and this planet that we live on, and this song just evokes that to me.
Right. Well, I do hope you sing more. And
well,
I want to
thank
you for talking with us. And why don't we end with your recording of The Wayfaring Stranger from your new CD, The Art of Song. And my guest has been Charlie Hayden. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Terry. I am a poor wayfaring stranger, a wandering through this world of woe, and there's no sickness, toil, or danger in that bright world to which I go. I'm going home to see my father.
Charlie Hayden from his 1999 CD, The Art of the Song. His latest CD is called Nocturne. His next CD, American Dreams, will be released in early October. Charlie Hayden celebrates his 65th birthday Tuesday. We wish him a very happy birthday. Coming up, Henry Sheehan reviews Steven Soderbergh's new film, Full Frontal. This is Fresh Air.
The director of such Hollywood films as Aaron Brockovich, Traffic, and Ocean's 11 has turned the camera on Hollywood itself. Steven Soderbergh's new film, Full Frontal, features Julia Roberts, David Duchovny, Catherine Keener, and David Hyde Pierce in a loosely connected series of vignettes that takes place during a single day in Hollywood. Film critic Henry Sheehan has a review.
The advertising campaign for Steven Soderbergh's Full Frontal contains the tantalizing phrase that it's the unauthorized sequel to Sex, Lies, and Videotape. Sex, Lies was the shot-on-video drama of romantic cruelty and alienation among four 20-somethings that shot out of Sundance in 1989 and went on to win the Palme d'Or at Cannes. After that came box office success and credit for launching the firestorm of independent American films which shot up theaters through the mid-1990s. Full Frontal's characters are older, and although it's mostly shot on videotape, it has significant stretches dedicated to a 35mm film within the film. But once again, we're in the land of sexual anime, only this time with six main characters instead of four, and a plot that meanders Altman style before tying itself together in that most arbitrary of devices, a birthday party. The six characters are actually three couples in various states, including deterioration, courtship, and even a minor one of pre-meeting featuring Mary McDonald and Enrico Colantoni. Yet the tongue-in-cheek claim about unauthorized sequel is legit. Full Frontal is every bit as pretentious and bad as Sex, Lies, and Videotape. A collection of discrete vignettes with no cumulative force, Coleman Huff's screenplay rattles between the arch and sentimental, that is, between the distractedly cruel and the indifferently mawkish. If that sounds like the description of a bad Hollywood script, the cast fits the description of a bad Hollywood bill. It's the sort that Hollywood marketeers love to plaster across full-page ads because it seems to cover so many demographic bases. Julia Roberts for the masses, Catherine Keener for the indie crowd, David Hyde Pierce for the high-class TV watchers, and, say no more, David Duchovny. A would-be irony among the movie's many is that Roberts is playing a Hollywood star, Francesca Davis, who's making the movie romance within the movie, along with Blair Underwood, who plays her co-star. Soderbergh has enough editorial skill to make all of this perfectly clear. He's never more than one step ahead of the audience, and he always knows just when to rest a moment and let the rest of us catch up. His sense of humor is impish enough that some of the silliness is enjoyable just as that, silliness. Here, for example, is a scene of Soderbergh allowing Roberts to goof around as Francesca, the movie star, as she bugs her personal assistant.
I'm starving to death.
Well, I've got it right here.
I might actually faint.
Okay, tuna. No celery.
No celery and no...
onion.
Right.
So, listen. You know that thing that we were talking about? I can't keep...
Come on, come on.
I'm uncomfortable dealing with this aspect of your life.
I don't want to talk to them.
Well, I don't want to talk to them either. I don't even want to talk to the guys I'm dating. They all seem pretty nice to me.
Well, they don't strike you as like networky, freaky, actress dating executive types that wear their water bottles in like a mesh tote bag. This is disgusting. I can't eat this.
Oh.
That arugula is so bitter. It's like my algebra teacher on bread.
Okay.
Ugh. I know.
I
might actually faint.
We all know how you get when your blood sugar's low.
You.
All right, I'll be right back.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I need some wet naps, too.
Okay.
Tuna fingers. Don't want tuna fingers.
No, we don't.
You're an angel, thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
Roberts delivers nearly all the funny stuff, but she's just playing counter notes to the movie's main themes. Those chords are heavily thrumped by Catherine Keener and David Hyde Pierce as Lee and Carl, a married couple on the verge of separation. Lee's a human resources VP at a large corporation. Carl's a staff writer at Los Angeles Magazine, and just why they're breaking up isn't exactly clear, but at least it's more transparent as to why they ever got together in the first place. As he did in Sex Lies, Soderbergh is playing cinematic psychologist, but the writer-director has never been comfortable with fluid selves. Quite the opposite. Take George Clooney's Thief in Ocean's 11. As soon as he's paroled from prison, he starts planning the exact same criminal activity that landed him there in the first place. Soderbergh is fascinated by characters who won't bend to the world and can make them come alive on screen brilliantly, to the point of bringing us right inside their guts. But more common souls, those who have to adjust to implacable realities and learn to live with disappointment, seem beyond him. It's odd, but the same director who can understand a quasi-honest Mexican drug cop so well has difficulty comprehending a semi-successful magazine writer.
Film critic Henry Sheehan is based in Los Angeles. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of The Medicine Wheel Garden, creating sacred space for healing, celebration, and tranquility by E. Barry Kavash. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
At the height of the AIDS epidemic in Harlem, babies infected with HIV were expected to die, but some survived for years. They were raised in hospitals. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with two pediatric AIDS doctors who've been working with the children known as border babies. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.